Mark Strand is a former U.S. Poet Laureate. What, that makes three U.S. Poet Laureates we've had on the show so far?
Yes, it is.
Mark Strand has received many, many awards, including perhaps the most prestigious award you can receive as a poet, the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. He has also received a MacArthur Fellowship, the Bobbitt Prize, the Bullingen Prize, the Gold Medal in Poetry, and a Rockefeller Foundation Award. He is arguably one of the most well-published, well-known poets in the United States, and he's certainly one of my favorite poets, and we're very glad to have him on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mark, Almost Invisible, really very much enjoyed this book, and what do you call this book?
I think you're referring to the pieces, whether they're
right.
Poetry or prose.
Right, exactly.
I don't consider them poetry, although almost everybody I talk to about them says they're prose poems. I don't really know what a prose poem is anymore. I thought I did it one time in my life. But I don't think, if I thought these were poems, I wouldn't have written them, because I thought I was taking a vacation from poetry. And I wrote them with the thought that I was writing short prose pieces, and pieces manifesting ideas that I might not, in some cases certainly would not, use in my poems. Some of these pieces are fable-like, some of them are domestic farces or domestic satire.
Mm-hmm.
Some are more meditative. Some act like poems, but of course they're written out as prose. I think their brevity is what may convince some people that they are poems. Some of them have a lyric identity, and they seem elegiac, which reminds them of poetry. But here again, if I thought they were going to be poems, I wouldn't have written them.
Well, that's interesting. You said you were taking a break from writing poetry. Can you talk about that?
Well, poetry is very demanding, at least as I write it. I rewrite a great deal, fussing over this or that detail, sometimes having to do with cadence and having to do with syntax or lineation, basic elements that go into the making of a poem. I just thought sometimes it was increasingly, I should say, exasperating to spend 1 or 2 weeks deciding whether to use the definite or indefinite article here. Struck me as a waste of time, since nobody else seemed to know the difference.
Right. After publishing Selected Poems in 1980, you took a decade off of poetry before you published your next book. Is this something you have to do occasionally, just get away from poetry? And when you do, what do you do during that time?
Well, that hiatus, which lasted really from 1980 to 1985, because I started writing poems again in 1985, and the poems that came out of that five-year period were published in a book called The Continuous
right.
Life. During that 5 years, I wrote a few children's books, I wrote a few art books, I wrote over 40 pieces of journalism, maybe more, I haven't really counted it up, but I was writing for Vogue magazine then, their photography critic. I also wrote a book of stories. I was busy,
wow.
And I was teaching at the same time. So, you know, it's not as if I stopped writing. It's
right.
just that I stopped writing poetry. I just find poetry exhausting. You know, I'm not a young guy anymore, although I sometimes act like a young guy.
Good for you.
In fact, I don't really know anymore what age-appropriate means.
You said poetry is really difficult for you. Was it always the case?
Yeah, I mean, I don't consider myself a natural writer. I hope that when people read my poems, they experience or imagine that they were written with a kind of ease, as if I were a natural writer, but I work very hard to create the illusion that these were written right off the bat, but carefully.
When you first started off, you studied at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I had just come back from a Fulbright in Italy, and there I was with a bunch of people who were all interested in writing, and I met Well, at least one of my best friends to this day there, Charles Wright, who I think is a great writer. It was great because here were 40 people who's somewhat like mine. That is, they thought that poetry was important enough for them to devote their lives to it. It was sort of great. And we had a great teacher in Donald Justice, who, another very careful writer, who is not given the kind of credit he should be given, because writing or poetry has gone off in quite another direction from the one Don Justice might have anticipated. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I was a young guy, and it was terrific fun, and to be around a lot of young poets, drinking beer, playing pinball machines, having parties, betting, playing cards a lot. And that was great. I wouldn't want to do it now.
We're talking to Mark Strand, whose latest book, Almost Invisible, has just been released. And it is a very, very short book. It's a book that you could read in one sitting, and it comprises these prose pieces. And one of the cool things about being able to read it in one sitting is it kind of stays with you, and you're able to go back and reread the ones that you like best. And I think one of the ones for me was The Minister of Culture Gets His Wish. And it says, nothing is elsewhere doing what nothing does, which is to expand the dark. And it's this search for nothing that seems to actually be a theme throughout the book in a certain sense. And what is this nothing? What is it? It's ineffable, I know. And once you start talking about nothing, then it becomes something. But
yeah, well, you hit the paradox right on the head when you said that. Nothing doesn't exist. I mean, as long as it exists in one's imagination as a possibility, we don't experience nothing. I mean, when we're dead, we are part of nothing. But dead people don't experience their death.
Right.
Their deadness, I should say. It's something to think about and something to perhaps imagine. I certainly play with it a lot in Almost Invisible. Mm-hmm. Since I'm inching my way towards the status of nothing in many, many ways. So, I mean, invisibility is a kind of state of nothingness. I sometimes feel I'm almost there.
You know, I think of that Kabbalistic concept of no thing, you know, that the God, the Ein Sof, is the no thing. I guess to find nothing is to find your own, yeah, I guess your own death. And there seems to be a lot of death in this book. Are you thinking a lot about death these days?
No, but I play with the idea. It's not that I'm fearful of anything. I think the idea of death is an inducement to imagine what it might be, since it's the one experience we must imagine, because when we experience it, it's too late to write. So, and as far as no thing goes, I think that domesticates the idea of nothing, because thing is an object, and when you take the object away, well, you still have had the thing. I just think that nothing is grander than that. That my idea of nothing is all of empty space, although now they talk about dark matter, and that it has weight, greater weight than, visible matter, so that the idea of nothing has been compromised by physics.
I had a friend who went to NYU, and you were doing a reading there one time, and he got the courage to go up to you and talk to you, and he said, I like your poems. And you said, which one? And all he could think of was your two most famous poems, Eating Poetry and Keeping Things Whole. And I have kind of two questions about this. Does it get tiring to be identified with those two particular poems all the time? And then secondly, that Keeping Things Whole, isn't there kind of like a resonance of the same ideas in that poem as there are in this Almost Invisible?
Oh, well, Yeah, I mean, it's first to answer the first part of your question. It is tiring to have those two poems singled out, you know, when I've written hundreds of other poems. It doesn't seem fair to the other poems.
Or your career, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, some of which I worked much harder on. Keeping Things Whole took me 20 seconds. Eating Poetry took me a little longer, but there's some poems that I really labored over for months and months to get right. And I wish more attention would be paid to those. Mm. So what was the other part of the question?
There seems to be a resonance of keeping things whole in this book. Even the cover, the image on the cover, is this guy standing out in a field, it almost looks like.
Yeah, well, that's an actual photograph of what the FDR looks like.
Oh, wow.
FDR Drive looks like from some vantage point over the East River. But, it seems to be the theme that runs the most consistent theme running through all of my poetry.
Yeah.
I have no control over it. It's just, I begin to write and, you know, something like keeping things whole comes up. Mm-hmm. Not always, but often enough that I would consider it characteristic of my poetry to conjugate presence and absence and presence, etc.
Right.
Mark, do you have Buddhist leanings?
Well, everybody says that. I mean, I'm not religious in the slightest, but I suppose from what I hear of Buddhism, I've not read anything about it. If I had to choose a religion, it would probably be Buddhism, because it really isn't a religion as far as it's been described.
Right, it really isn't. But I really, maybe because I've been reading some Buddhist teachings and writings lately, and then that's the context of which I read your latest book, I thought, I wonder if Mark's a Buddhist.
I still have time ahead of me. I may become one.
You are a trained painter, and you wrote a book on Edward Hopper. Of course, his most famous painting as Nighthawks, that image of the at night with people in the city in a cafe, very famous image. And you describe the painting, you say, characters whose parts have deserted them and now trapped in the space of their waiting must keep themselves company with no clear place to go, no future. It's almost as if you're describing your own poetry there. Is it safe to say that Edward Hopper has been a big influence on the way you see?
Well, no, I think what it is this. I think we have similar sensibilities, but I don't think the way I see was gotten from Hopper. I just think that we tend to see the world in the same way, and I think what you've just read is a description of a great many American lives, and I think that Hopper put his finger on something there. I think Americans are quite lonely as a people, and they're desperate for company. That's why they surround themselves with talking machines like television and radio and chat rooms or whatever that
Facebook.
Is. Facebook. And you know, they drive here and there in their cars. You don't see them meeting often in cafes the way in Europe people get together and drink coffee in cafes or have a drink in the late afternoon. Here they go to bars where the noise is so overwhelming, like you can't communicate with another human being. Voices are drowned out. But Hopper's world is a lot emptier than the world we have today. I mean, his figures are generally isolated figures, and they're in offices or rooms that are fairly bare.
You've been in American letters for a long time. How do you see that American poetry in particular has changed, and do you think it's changed for the better?
Well, it's changed. Back in the 50s, there was the War of the Anthologies. You know, the academic poetry, which was quite neat in meter and rhyme, and verse forms were employed here, you know, almost everywhere. And then there were the beats and the so-called raw poetry, which was largely free verse, in which, you know, was a reinvestigation or a rebirth of Whitmanian expansiveness, and that was different. Today, I don't know. I mean, so much has conspired to change poetry. One of the things that has is the internet and writing on computers, where the poetry has become, it doesn't sound like poetry to me anymore because I don't think it's written out in longhand.
Right.
And it doesn't have that, you know, when I write poems, I write them in longhand because I feel the rhythm, you know, a kind of physical rhythm as well as the audio rhythm, hearing the poems. And if you're staring into a computer, you're just responding visually to something. And not only that, but the poems achieve the look of a finished poem rather more quickly than they do if you're writing in longhand.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, Denise Levertov said the same thing to me in terms of her writing process of poems.
That is really interesting that on the screen it looks finished, and that could, I guess, have an effect on the poet thinking that it's finished.
Yeah, before its time, you know.
That's interesting.
I mean, one of the great cautions that I have is not to think I have a poem finished before it's actually finished. And when you print out a poem that you've typed into the computer, it looks almost as if it were torn from a page of a book. I mean, it looks very finished. And as long as it's in longhand, you know you have more work to do. And when you run out of gas and you can't think of anything more, you type it up, and then you see, well, there are flaws here, and then you begin making changes, and you go back to longhand again, and then you finally, at the end, I put it into the computer. But it's I resist as much as I can. Although now, as I said earlier, I'm not really writing poems so much, just writing prose. It's easier to write prose directly on the computer, although I will say this, in Almost Invisible, that they were all written out in longhand, and I didn't fuss over the changes as I would when I write poetry or when I wrote poetry. I no more than two or three drafts in any of those. Some half of them were just written right out as you read them, and that was in itself a great relief. I just felt this tremendous sense of liberation.
But I think a lifetime of writing has given you this great skill, and that is that there's a lot of exactitude in this work, in these pieces, which I truly admire.
Yeah, well, I believe in clarity. I believe in exactitude. Yeah, I mean, that's what I work hard at. It's not easy. People who think you can just sit down and write a wonderfully clear sentence are mistaken. Yeah, you can take any sentence and write it many different ways. And the trick is to find the best way, the clearest, and at the same time, not just the clearest, but the one that seems most alive, and most resonant, and most beautiful.
Do you have a favorite piece among these prose pieces?
I have two that I like more than, I think, the others. One is called Those Little Legs and Awful Hands, and the other is Mysterious Arrival, the something arrival of a mysterious letter, the strange arrival or the inexplicable arrival of a mysterious letter.
The title is The Mysterious Arrival of an Unusual Letter.
Yeah, yeah. And the other one I really like is a very short one called In the Afterlife. In its brevity, it's one that's most like a poem.
Are you still painting?
Well, I didn't really paint for years. I was an art student, and over the years I've made little collages, bad ones, and drawings. But I've gone back to making collages in a serious way, and with the help of Dudonné, a paper maker in Manhattan here in New York. They've been very generous, helping me, teaching me to make papers, the kind of papers I can use in collages. And my French publisher is doing a book of them.
Oh, wow. And will that be available here as well?
Well, it'll be available in one bookstore in New York, but mainly in Europe and also in China. I'm having my first show, big show, in Shanghai at the James Cohan Gallery there.
Well, congratulations, Mark.
Can people view your work anywhere? Is there a web page or any place that they can...
No, I don't have a web page. There are some old collages that they can dig up online, but they're not representative of what I do now. You know, I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on LinkedIn. I'm not. I don't have a web page. I don't do any of that stuff. I guess if I were 25, I'd do all of it.
Right.
I'd do it three or four times. No, I don't think so. I think, but you may be able to, if you go to the James Cohan Gallery. I mean, you in China. Shanghai, maybe they'll certainly have it online. It's going to be, and I know their brochure they're printing up will have several reproductions, plus a strange text I wrote in which I interview myself. I wrote a fake interview.
Oh, nice!
I invented a Dr. Melissa Birdwell, PhD, who interviews me.
You know, I got to tell you this story. I was at the airport one time waiting for my flight, and I saw somebody who I thought looked like you, or at least one of the images of you in, on the back of one of your books.
Mm-hmm.
And you're very tall and strapping and very handsome. And suddenly I got this image with everybody in the airport was Mark Strand. All the people walking were all Mark Strand. The baby in the baby strollers were all Mark Strand. It was quite an image, and I never wrote about it, but I'm glad to get to share that with you.
Whoa, it's terrifying.
It was weird. It was weird.
I'm glad I wasn't walking through the airport.
We've been talking to Mark Strand today on Words on a Wire. Mark, you want to do us a favor and read one of your prose pieces for us on the air?
Great.
Is there anyone you want me to read?
Oh, how about the poem of the Spanish poet? That's a good one. Because that
poem is very odd. I mean, the poem that I make up in that is kind of like a fake translation of a Lorca
I found
poem.
It very funny, actually.
But, you know, in Spain, I mean, this book is translated into Spanish, too. It doesn't sound good at all. It sounds like a lousy American poem.
Oh, boy.
I'll read it, though. Dream of the Spanish Poet. In a hotel room somewhere in Iowa, an American poet, tired of his poems, tired of being an American poet, leans back in his chair and imagines he is a Spanish poet, an old Spanish poet nearing the end of his life, who walks to the Guadalquivir and watches the ships gray and ghostly in the twilight slip downstream. The little waves approaching the grassy bank where he sits whisper something he can't quite hear as they curl and fall. Now what does the Spanish poet do? He reaches into his pocket, pulls out a notebook, and writes, "Black fly, black fly, why have you come? Is it my shirt, my new white shirt with buttons of bone? Is it my suit, my dark blue suit? Is it because I lie here alone under a willow cold as stone? Black fly, black fly, how good you are to come to me now. How good you are to visit me here, black fly. Black fly to wish me goodbye."
That was Mark Strand reading from Almost Invisible, his new book of prose pieces.
Thanks again, Mark, for being on our show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
An honor.
Okay.